Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, and we're going to be continuing to read the last part of the Rolling Stone article about Adele. Adele wanted to modernize her sound to add synths, drum pads, and move away from her young folky vibe of 21 on River Lee. Her track with Danger Mouse, she sings over choir-like keyboard chords created from her own sampled voice. This time, it's about trying to come up with the weirdest sounds I could get away with, says Epworth, who co-wrote two tracks on 25. This album feels like it fits in maybe more with cultural dialogue and instead of being an anachronistic to it. It's almost like she's trying to beat everyone else at their own game. There's roughly an album full of worth of outtakes from 25. Adele is ruthless in her quality control, and she's still making final tweaks to the track list when we met. Some songs are not fucking good enough, she says. And I think that's where a lot of people go wrong, thinking that people will buy any old shit from you. Adele celebrated a recent birthday at Kurobuta, a Japanese pub food spot with a cultivated rock and roll vibe. The Guardian described it as both insanely delicious and ridiculously expensive. Tonight she's returned and the restaurant has arranged for us to have a private candlelit room in the back down a small flight of stairs. We have comically huge distressed wood communal table to ourselves. Sometimes it's good to be raucous, to be a random girl from London. As we study the menu, which is heavy on fried foods, Adele is amused to hear I'm trying to eat low carb. Let's cheat, she says persuasively. Behind her are various vintage rock posters, including the cover of Jimi Hendrix's Axe as Bold as Love. Let's both cheat. It's my cheat day. Let's go mad. She looks at the menu again. I'm going in. I'm going ham. Hard as a motherfucker. She glances at the empty corner. Last time we were here, they had a TV in there, she says. They must have taken it all out. But it was showing like hardcore porn. It was just mad. It's a bit off-putting when you're eating, like, sushi and they've got all the hardcore porn stuff on. She orders an amaretto sour, what she calls a Days of Our Lives drink, but then changes it to a glass of Sauvignon Blanc. I don't know if I should be that fierce, she says. I just remembered I'm being interviewed. Adele is aware of certain critics have used her classy image and music as a cudgel against the Mileys of the world. She's not really into it. I'd rather not be the person that everyone gets pitted against, she says. If they do decide to get their body out, I would rather not be that person because I'm just pitting a woman against another woman, and I don't hold any moral high ground than anyone else. So it's pissed me off a bit. Not that I'm going to start getting my tits out now. She continues to think out loud. Would I show my body off if I was thinner? Probably not, because my body is mine. But sometimes I'm furious to know if I would have been as successful if I wasn't plus size. Now I remind everyone of themselves. I think that not everyone is my size, but it's relatable because I'm not perfect. And I think a lot of people are portrayed as perfect, unreachable, and untouchable. She finds a lot of questions she's faced on the issues about being blatantly sexist. When I'm asked what I do, Playboy, that's so many fucking times it's ridiculous. And that's because I'm a woman or because I'm fat. Then again, she took note of the fuss made over a certain male celebrity when he slimmed down. What I found really interesting was the big deal that was made out of Chris Pratt. When he lost all his weight, it was, oh my God, who would have known he was so fucking fit? But it was a lot of tension on what he used to be bigger. I've never seen that with a guy. Adele has been so busy in the past few years, she's only faintly aware of the newfound prominence of feminism in the cultural discourse. It's a movement. That's great. Who's doing it? Well, if you ask me, I'm a feminist. I don't think many men in interviews get asked if they're feminist. I don't ask questions, but she wants to answer anyway. I'm a feminist, she says, sipping wine. I believe that everyone should be treated the same, including race and sexuality. She recalls not being taken seriously in a business meeting full of men and encountering an attitude of, what do you know? It's like, well, I'm the fucking artist, she says, sitting straight up in her chair. So I fucking know everything, actually. Like, don't fucking talk down to me. She enjoyed working with Sia for her new album, even though the songs didn't make it. One, Alive, became a single for Sia instead. Adele realized she'd never collaborated with a woman before. I actually love the dynamic of both us being in there and just fucking being bossy, she says with a laugh. It's all those male producers and they're all fucking shitting themselves because we're in there. Do you think everyone will be disappointed that I'm happy, Adele's asked. It's a couple of days after our dinner and she's wearing a similar legging sweater ensemble with a glam edition of glittery boots. We're sitting in her manager's bright modern office on a quiet Notting Hill street, decorated with sports memorabilia and some of Adele's prizes. She points out her Ivor Novello Songwriting Award in the corner, but neglects to mention of her Diamond Award next to it, which commemorates her more than 10 million copies sold in the U.S. Adele knows her songs have been solace to her fans. If my music can heal anyone's heart, then it's like, that's the most satisfying thing ever. I don't think the record has a vibe of woohoo, I'm totally happy, but I'm being in a brighter space with my love life. Will my fans be disappointed in me that I can't fix their broken hearts with a song that's brokenhearted? I don't want to disappoint them, but at the same time, I can't write a sad record like for everyone else. That's not a real record unless I'm sad. She laughs at the reminder that her last Rolling Stone interview ended with her imagining what would happen if she was in a stable relationship. No music, she joked then. My fans will be like, babe, please get divorced. But she doesn't see it that way anymore. It'll be a bit tragic to do a heartbreak album again. A cliche, not even tragic. It would be such a cliche. What if I was heartbroken? Excuse me. What the fuck would I write about? I can't write a fucking heartbreak record again, so just flip and reverse it. She does understand the artist's temptation to create chaos in their lives. I would have been totally up for that had I not had a kid. I didn't think I'd settle down. I always loved the drama, you know. Always wanted to be in love and always loved the drama since I was very young. The question of a tour looms large in Adele's mind, and she's giving herself until Christmas to decide. When I sat down and thought, what can I do to bring something new to the table, it was just like, tour, because I haven't done it properly. And as she sees it, this album might be her last chance for many years to hit the road. Once Angelo's in school, she doesn't want to take him out. Adele's always had stage fright, with a particular fear of opening her mouth on stage and having nothing come out, which is peculiar because she's already lost her voice and regained it. But it didn't happen in mid-show, she says, waving off the idea. She also has the unlikely vision of walking out on stage and seeing only 5 people in the arena. She dreads having more throat problems. If my throat goes, then I'll never be able to tour again. I'll be able to get my throat fixed again and do studio work, but I would want to do something and then fail at it and be too scared to ever try it again. Whatever she does perform, she promises to embrace her old stuff, joking that she's forever 21. Being defined by any record is a dream come true when you're an artist. It's like I go and see certain bands, not to name any, and they don't play their fucking biggest hits. Cunts. That really annoys me. To to the general public, it's not about your body of work. It's, in most cases, it's about the song that reminds them of something in their lives. They take you into their heart. That's like my biggest thing ever, she smiles, eyes alight with all the music left to be made. You have to play that song. Okay, it's the end of our Dale article. Let's see what else we can find in here that might be of interest. I think I got a couple of record reviews I want to read for you. Okay, here's one. The ultimate clash of teen pop titans. Justin Bieber asks fans to take him back while One Direction moves toward the exit. Justin Bieber's album is Purpose, and it's got 3.5 out of 4 stars. One Direction, Made in the AM, it's got 4 out of 4 stars. Here's the review. Justin Bieber and One Direction have always been the yin and yang of pop idol game, but never so much more than now. They bring opposite agendas to their new music. Bieber is the comeback kid, begging for forgiveness and vowing to be a better Bieber. But One Direction are racing for the exit, announcing a split. Hopefully temporary, because life is harsh enough. They've got a few parting gifts for their girl, almighty fan army. Their records sound nothing alike, but they have the same moral. Teen girls are the only fans that matter. And if you're a dude singer, you treat those girls right, because they can make or break you at will. Purpose comes after Bieber's Take Me Back moment at the Video Music Awards, weeping on stage. It's full of motivational Bieb talk about the realness of the Bieb struggle. You find your purpose and realize your life is worth living, because Bieber is for the children. His mid-tempo R&B gets a welcome boost from Skillerex. The synth elephant blurts in Sorry and Where Are You Now? Halsey and Travis Scott. Unlikely maturity bring Big Sean adds to the entertainingly cloddish flair. I eat the cookie like I'm Lucius. Made in the AM is One Direction's Let It Be. The cover has a Beatle-worthy body language, 4 boys in a cheap couch, Liam Payne and Niall Horan smiling in opposite directions. Louis Tomlinson and Harry Styles staring defiantly into your eyes. Lots of sensitive breakup songs here. Hey girl, before you go, let's toast to many bars and expensive cars and the good champagne and the private planes. But it sure doesn't sound like a band that's hanging it up, because all 4 are on a roll musically. Chasing a rock vibe of Midnight Memories and 4. The Britpop loop Hey Angel is a dead ringer for Verve's Bittersweet Symphony. And what a feeling, Spike's hooks from at least 6 different Fleetwood Mac hits. In case you thought they were flawless, there's the folky, I Want to Write You a Song. Please, guys, no boat symbolism on the solo LPs, okay? Well, Walking in the Wind comes from a noble boy band tradition, the ballad that bids farewell to the audience at the end of each gold rush, a la the Bay City Rollers, The Way I Feel Tonight, or the Backstreet Boys' Shape My Heart. There's nothing coy about it, with lines like goodbyes are bittersweet and we had some times, didn't we? One Direction reprised their sentiment in the finale, AM, in which all 4 co-write, joining their voices, swimming around in our glasses and talking out of our asses, talking about going out on top. That's the way to go, boys, out on top. Here's a record review for Chris Isaak. First Comes the Night, 3 out of 4 stars. Rockabilly's greatest modern ambassador goofs off with mostly fun results. Reinvention must be challenging for Chris Isaak, who's long branded himself the suavest living Elvis-style crooner. Alongside his valiant attempt to add gravitas to the judging panel of this season's X Factor Australia comes his latest Nouveau Retro Nashville session that dials back that gravitas instead. Don't Break My Heart is a campy cha-cha driven by TV game show organ, and Isaac has never sang anything as wicked as Down in Flames, a rockabilly strut backing with hip swivels through a death wish. Kenny got in the back of a got it in a Lincoln. Caesar got it in the back. It's a fun set, but hit or miss, and in the end, the best songs are played straight. See, Kiss Me Like a Stranger, a wash with brushed snares, and Bigsby Bar Vibrato, a ballad true to form, conjures a 1950s David Lynch dream sequence down to the scent of Brill Cream. Okay, here's a Demi Lovato review. Confident. 3.5 stars out of 4. Ex-Disney star builds on Cool for the Summer with a strong, sleek album. Demi Lovato's 5th studio LP is an album she was born to make, a brassy, sleek, dynamic pop production that lets her powerful vocals soar to new emotional highs. It kicks off with a fast and furious title track, a bright jolt of energy that sounds like a video game in the best way. Her should-have-been song of the summer single, Cool for the Summer, remains fresh, fun, and sexy. On Kingdom Come, she takes a luxurious clip in post-Dark Horse trap pop, which works brilliantly until guest MC Iggy Azalea's faux Big Sean flow drowns out the song's buzz. But the most impressive thing about Confident is Lovato's mastery of the power ballad form. Check the raw soul she brings to Stone Cold. Better still, his father, a gospel-infused dedication to Lovato's late abusive father that closes out the album for showing just how much this former Disney star has grown. Okay, we're going to go back in time a little bit here on the back page. This is Rolling Stone chart from 1975. Let's see if you remember this one. Number one, Someone Saved My Life Tonight, Elton John. Number two, Jive Talking, the Bee Gees. Number three, I'm Not in Love, 10cc. Number four was Rhinestone Cowboy by Glen Campbell. Number five was Why Can't We Be Friends by War. Number six was One of These Nights by the Eagles. Number seven was How Sweet It Is, James Taylor. Number eight was Please, Mr. Please, Olivia Newton-John. Number nine was Falling in Love by Hamilton, Joe Frank, and Reynolds. And the number 10 song in 1975 was, August 16th, that is, was The Rockford Files by Mike Post. Let's go to the front of the magazine and find a few more little things to read. Here's a little story about Phil Collins. You remember Phil Collins, don't you? Phil Collins' unlikely return, inside the singer's dark days and plans for a comeback. Sitting on a couch in the master bedroom of this new $33 million Miami Beach mansion, Phil Collins doesn't look like a man gearing up for a huge comeback. The 64-year-old just had a surgery to repair nerves in his back, and even sitting up is a monumental challenge. His voice is soft and groggy. That is, until conversation turns to his future plans. I'm no longer officially retired, he says, growing animated. The horse is out of the stable, and I'm raring to go. Collins hasn't played live since 2010 and still hasn't recorded in more than a decade. My kids are 10 and 14, and they want to see what their dad does, he says. They were in nappies when I was last on the road. Last year, Collins secretly reconvened his solo band with Jason Bonham on the drums for a 3-week rehearsal. His manager is laying early groundwork for for a tour. Those exact plans are still up in the air. Collins suffered major nerve damage to his hands while drumming on the 2000 Genesis reunion tour, but he's hopeful his back operation will restore his skills. After surgery, the doctor said to me that all my vital signs were there. He said, if I want to play drums again, all you have to do is practice. Even as Collins is barely able to stand, he's having a new studio set up on the ground floor of his house, and he hopes to cut a new album. No matter what happens, he says, I can still play piano and sing. I'll settle for the parts of me I could still possibly do. Collins is returning at a time when his musical legacy is stronger than ever, perhaps surprisingly. In the 1980s, Collins was derided by rock critics as the epitome of soft rock cheese. But since he retreated from the spotlight, he's gained new respect. In the Air Tonight, a widely held as a masterpiece of pop cultural touchstone, Mike Tyson sang along to it in The Hangover. Stephen Curry of the Golden State Warriors sang it in a viral video. Even Adele reached out to him about possibly co-writing songs for her new album. His last album of new material was 2002's Testify, and in 2011 he announced his retirement from public life, opting to focus on his children and his favorite hobby, collecting Alamo artifacts. I sometimes think I'm going to write this Phil Collins character out of the story, he told Rolling Stone that year. Phil Collins will just disappear or be murdered in some hotel room, and people will say, what happened to Phil? The answer will be, he got murdered, but yeah, anyway, let's carry on. His retirement plans took a severe blow. His wife moved with their young sons to Miami, far from his main home near Geneva, Switzerland. It left me with a lot of time on my hands to think about what happened. I went through bits of darkness, drinking too much. Ultimately, he drank to the point where he developed pancreatitis and even tried rehab for a week before realizing it wasn't for him. I killed my hours watching TV and drinking, and it almost killed me, he says. But I haven't had a drink in 3 years. After sobering up, Collins bought the 12,000-square-foot Miami Beach home of former owner was Jennifer Lopez this summer, right down the road from Barry Gibb, and began seeing the boys nearly every day. He even set up a soundproof room where his 14-year-old Nicholas could practice with his band. Things seemed perfect until Collins woke one morning and discovered that he couldn't move his right foot. I had an MRI and my back and hips were just shot. The doctor said I had to go in there and work on the sciatic nerve and take my back apart and unscramble the mess. For now, Collins is focused on the deluxe edition of his solo albums, which hit the shelves January 29. They're packed with demos, outtakes, and alternate versions of songs from throughout his career. I got very involved in these reissues. We even reshot all the covers, which was my idea. I'm easily flattered. If people rediscover the old stuff and show interest, it would be silly not to make more music. News of Collins' return is likely to excite Genesis fans, but he's noncommittal about the idea of another reunion tour. Let's just start with the solo bit first, he says. I love the guys, but I prefer to do this first. For now, let's just see how this goes. Okay, let's see if we can find another little story. Here we go. Bonnie Raitt's most personal album in years. Raitt digs deep, gets noisy with a longtime band on her first album since 2012. Bonnie Raitt's new studio album, Dig In Deep, won't be out until February, but the singer-guitarist has already received her first rave review. I got an email from Jackson, Raitt says, meaning her friend Jackson Brown. He said, I love the way you use the band as a band. It really sounds cohesive. The LP title comes from a line in the opening stomp of Unintended Consequence of Love. It's also Raitt's allusion to how she and her longtime studio and road band, guitarist George Marinelli, bassist James Hutchinson, drummer Ricky Fattar, with recent recruit Mike Finnegan on keyboards, have become a unit that can dig deeper into the grooves, she says. Two covers come from the 80s, freshened with blues rock swagger and rates toward slide guitar. In Excess's Need You Tonight and Los Lobos' Shakin' Shakes. We make a lot of noise for four people and me, rate 66 notes proudly. Dig In Deep is her most personal record in years, with Rate's highest tally of original songs since 1998's Fundamental. I had a lot of loss, Rate says, referring to the passing of her mother Marjorie, father John, and her brother Steve between 2004 and 2009. She points out the resurgent energy and the gospel influence, What You're Doing to Me. We all get shuttered down by life, and sometimes people blast the door open and pull you out, she said. Well, let's see. That's probably about it for today. Thanks for listening. Have a great night. Great day wherever you are. See you next time. Bye.